Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2001 with a Millennium Grant from the good old Scarman Trust. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com/dialect. This week, Simon Bale, the radical atheist turned Church of England vicar, now working down in Bridgewater. What caused that conversion? Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk and based at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, the Arts Centre on Jamaica Street. If you have someone you'd like us to interview or would like to volunteer, have a pen and paper ready at the end of the show.
My name is Simon Bale. I used to live in Bristol for 51 years, and in 2013 I was ordained into the Church of England and moved to Highbridge.
Okay, before you carry on, what made this move, I suppose fairly late in life, why did you decide to get ordained?
God called me. That's a spooky and weird thing to say, isn't it?
Did you really?
I call it my ET moment. You know, an ET when he starts to glow in the middle. That's how faith is to me. It's a very, very Hollywood version of it. But I was an atheist until I was 38 in 1999.
So what happened? Did you have some sort of Billy Graham moment?
I had a real bit of a psychological moment.
Thank God for that.
Well, indeed. People would say to me, oh, Simon, God wasted 38 years. And I say, nah, God never wastes anything. I was the your radical atheist. I was a new atheist before Dawkins coined the word.
So what prompted the change then?
Well, when I became a Christian, realised I was a Christian, it was only a matter of months, really, before I was starting to think about where next. Because I'm just a sort of... I'm an obsessive, I suppose, and I want to get on with things and I want to be in the middle of things. And it felt like if I was just being a Christian, then actually, you know, I needed to really, really be a Christian.
So did you have a sort of amazing light bulb moment? Was it a gradual process?
Gradual. And I think that's how my theology is in the world. It's a natural theology of people emerge into understanding the world around them. I don't think that Damascus moments happen very often. I'm very cynical about that personally. I have revelations. I have moments of clarity and think, aha, yes, that's what it's all about. But that's part of the growth as well. There's, you know, it's shift and drift, I suppose you'd call it.
So, what about where did you go to study, and do you come to actually be ordained?
Well, I was confirmed as an Anglican in 2002, 16th of June, and that was, you know, I was still thinking, okay, what does it mean? I never thought me a priest. You know, I mean, I've been all my adult life been this biologist, scientist, atheist, evolutionist, and I still am. Just take out the atheist, and it took me 5 or 6 years to really gather what was needed. And in 2008, I started seriously thinking about it. So that was 8 years on, I suppose. But in that time, I'd been pushed by people, I'd been encouraged by people, and I felt that I had to do it. It just was the obvious next step.
It's one of those questions I always like asking, particularly to people who, you know, have a responsibility for looking after the flock, is how does God speak to you? Where does God speak to you? Or doesn't he?
Again, it's a language problem, isn't it? I mean, God is a mystery. God, I recognise God rather than being spoken to by God. I see God in the rubbish around us. A friend of mine used to be the Bishop of Malmesbury. Said the more he believes in the incarnation, the more he sees the value of the sewage system, because you realise the humanity that we all are has waste and difficulty, and it's in that that you notice God. It's the bright, shining feeling of warmth, the joy when you're dealing with somebody or talking to somebody who's at the rock bottom and having the sense that you've helped them in their hope. Hope, for me, is where it all comes from, I suppose, in that regard. I mean, ask me tomorrow and I come up with a whole different range of things. But at the moment, the idea of hope for me, if I may use a rather sort of trivial analogy, is carrying a bag full of shopping in a really ropey carrier bag, and it's cutting through your hands, and you're trying to get the door open, and you know if you put it down it'll all go rolling around, you're hanging onto the bag and you think the handles are going to strap, your hope is that it won't break until you've got in the door. And that's what hope is. Hope isn't nice and comfortable and painless. It's actually hard work. And finding hope, knowing there's hope and hanging on to the hope in the world is what I feel is God gives me. When I hear that, when I feel that hope, I feel God.
One of the basic things of tenets of Christianity is supposed to be, anyway, this whole thing of original sin. In other words, you really have to work very hard in order to be a good person, a moral person, a decent person. And if you don't work incredibly hard at it, then you start to slip. Is that something you agree? Do you recognise that or not?
I recognise that we are in a world which is the laws of the universe. I am a scientist. I subscribe to all kinds of Einsteinian and quantum theology and things like that, quantum theory, which leads to quantum theology. And I recognise that the world is a place which has which degrades. It's seeking to break down.
There's entropy.
Entropy. I wasn't going to use a word, but in case nobody understood me, but there is entropy in the world.
This is Newton, isn't it?
It's all kinds of physicists. I mean, we know the guys on the shoulders of others, but for me, every day is a new day, and every day is looking forward, and every day we fail to look forward properly. This is what you would call in academic circles process theology.
But I mean, sometimes circumstances can actually force you, so you can hardly see beyond the end of each day, let alone see tomorrow, next week.
That's the trouble with original sin, I feel. I mean, I'm going against making all kinds of heresies now, but the problem with original sin is it implies that there's a beginning, a middle, and an end in a lovely, comfortable, sort of organized manner. But actually, lives are not that beginning, middle, and end. Okay, you have birth and you die, but actually, we are here for a fleeting moment. And in that time, our certainly Western culture tries to mechanize everything to solve the problems. And actually, original sin is part of that trying to solve the problem. There is sin in the world. You can call sin, I call sin failing to do what you know is right. So when I do things wrong, I've sinned. But I don't think, because I was fallen 10,000 years ago.
Do you have to find out by making mistakes what's right and what's wrong? I mean, sometimes children seem to know better than adults.
Yeah, and we still do things wrong. You know, it is a thing which happens. You can get wrapped up. There's a paradox in the heart of it. The paradox is that you know it's wrong, so you shouldn't do it, and yet you do anyway. Because you know it's wrong, you will seek forgiveness, and yet you do it again. People criticize faith for that. Certainly they criticize Christianity because Augustine made this wonderful edifice of original sin into such an impossible thing to climb that we are now wrapped up so much in denying ourselves, which is that we are all difficult to get on with.
So it's a bit difficult though, isn't it, to marry up creation, the idea that God has made these various creatures, mankind, with evolution. You know, this idea that, you know, everything's kind of bubbled up from some kind of puddle, and, you know, whatever it is, a snail becomes a bird, becomes, you know, whereabouts do you sit?
I am very much, as I say, a natural theologian. I look around the world and I see evidence of God's love in the world. I can't prove it. You don't ask me to prove the existence of God. I would just say meaningless idea. Now, interestingly, before I became a Christian, the idea of God was a meaningless idea. But now I'm recognizing that trying to make sense of it is a meaningless idea.
I'm trying to pin you down on evolution.
Evolution. I am an evolutionist.
So does one little cell sort of slowly became all these various different things?
Oh, yeah.
Rather than God made something.
Oh, yes.
Another thing.
For me, it's I totally and utterly convinced of the value of Darwin's theory.
So is that in the Bible?
Oh, well, the Bible's not a manual, not a science textbook. It's a manual for living.
Let's get back to your move from Bristol down to Bridgewater, because when you were in Bristol, I know you were involved, as when I first came across you, Simon, when you were involved in various organisations, I think one particular one, I can't remember the name of, where you were trying to bring churches in the city together.
Well, now, faith communities in general.
For me, this is an immensely powerful idea. Mm. So what happened there?
Well, it was Communities Organised for Greater Bristol was the sort of last incarnation of it, or Active Communities Together, actually, was the final one. We ran out of money eventually. I mean, that was the big problem.
The church has got a lot of money, isn't it? Surely the Anglican, the Catholics have got a vast amount.
Yeah.
But they can't fund this.
But there's a lot of money wrapped up in the church, certainly, but it's how it's spent is obviously open to...
I suppose they're questioning, is it right to fund something which is actually funding other churches?
Well, indeed. The big thing with that in regards to the mainstay of church finance was, you know, are we biting the hand that feeds us and that sort of thing. But it is actually, I mean, it came out of an idea of the great organizer of America, Saul Alinsky, who worked in Chicago after the war, putting together, joining together very different kinds of community organizations, mostly faith communities, to work together for social action. And that was what COGB was. And actually, although I haven't been involved in that now for, you know, almost 2 decades, gosh, I feel old. The lessons I learned from that still roll with me about leadership and about common agendas and about utterly the most important thing of all is relationships. If people understand each other, then they can work together. And it's when we don't understand that our tribes overwhelm us. We all live in tribes.
I suppose the various different churches in Bristol are tribes.
Absolutely.
And the different faith communities are tribes.
Absolutely. And even within churches, you will have tribes. I mean, yeah. One church I was at was the 8 o'clock service on a Sunday and the 10 o'clock service, and they didn't meet.
Never the twain shall
meet. Absolutely. And you've got to live with that. But actually, getting to know people, which is personally how I like to live my life, I think of myself as a piece of Velcro which people stick to. And the more Velcro you have, the more relationships you make, the more community organizing you can do. Once you're trying to be separate from people, then you've lost the plot. And that's where COGB was very powerful in teaching the value of relationships.
But don't you get a sort of dilution of the message or dilution of what you're doing if you're saying, well, everyone here is welcome?
No. I say that being very bold, very much a follower of Jesus, which was about unity and about saying everyone is welcomed. I'm now also a member or an advocate or ambassador for Inclusive Church, which is a national organisation which grew out of the difficulty with sexuality in the church. But it's now all about all kinds of inclusion. And I see that as fundamental. I mean, you shouldn't actually need Inclusive Church because church is inclusive. It's about the whole of God's creation. But people do naturally, and I understand this, the human condition is to separate out into tribes again.
So is the devil welcome in church too?
Well, let me tell you a little story about that. a couple of years back, I was reading the banns at the beginning of a service. The banns are when we say, if these two people are going to get married, anybody here, got any reason they shouldn't, and let us know, that sort of thing. And it was the week that there had been something in the news about same-sex marriage. And a lady came up to me after the church service and said to me, Simon, how will you feel when you are able to read the banns of a same-sex couple? And I, pausing for breath, said, I'll be overjoyed. And she said, well, I shall leave the church. I sort of had to do some real soul-searching because I thought, well, I want you in the church, and yet you disagree completely with my attitude. Now, I'm not saying she was the devil. I'm not saying that in any way, but it's the idea.
Sounds like she was saying you were the devil.
Well, indeed, the idea of Satan is an obstructor, is a barrier,
divider.
It's a divider, yeah. And I think if we are going to be true,
you know,
to the
Freemasons
message,
dividers suddenly spring to mind.
Well, fair enough. Satan is a notional break, a barrier in how we work together. And I think in that respect, it's almost not a nonsensical question. I want that lady to be part of the church. She doesn't want to be part of my church. So I don't say she can ever can be. And I want to bring her back. But she and I are very good friends. But there's an issue of boundaries and barriers in that, which is something we all struggle with. Part of the sin.
This is one of the, I think, still attractive things about Christianity, whatever anyone says about it, is this whole idea, the revolutionary idea, really, of love thy enemy.
Absolutely. We all talk about the neighbour. Neighbours, you can love neighbours very easily.
I think this really rocked the boat back 2,000 years ago, you know, when this was said, what are you talking about? Love your enemy.
Yes, indeed. And we are still there. And that's the weird thing. Although a lot of Christians would say, isn't it wonderful Jesus came to die for us? And I think, yeah, great, let's go with that. But we're still in the do. Yeah. You know, there's still a lot of suffering in the world.
It hasn't quite sunk in yet.
No, and there's all kinds of reasons for that. But again, the human condition in me manifests as a Christian, which is to save as much as I can of the goodness in the world for us all. Whereas there are people who don't see that, and I want them to understand that. So I want them to have an ET moment.
What do you make of the Muslim thing? Because we've seen ever since the 9/11 attacks, really, ever since the dawn of the 21st century, really, Islam has become, we've got this word Islamophobia now, as we've heard anti-Semitism mentioned.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, certainly the Nazis were intent on extermination of the rabbinic tradition in Europe. This is one of the things they wanted. They began by getting Jews to emigrate to Palestine and ended up just wanting to exterminate that whole knowledge. We've also got this situation since the turn of the century where Islam seems to be under attack as well. You know, you've got Afghanistan, you've got the various countries in the Middle East, as well as Africa, African Muslim countries. You would be, I suppose, a bit two-dimensional if you didn't notice that there was some sort of similarity between the anti-Semitism and Islamophobia. Yeah. So what's happening there?
Again, at one level, at the high level, it is again a form of global tribalism. I think there are powers at work which are wanting to maintain their own security. You could argue it's a hunt for resources. It's a fear that people won't have resources in a multi or transnational way. At the root of it, where we perceive it as humans, as individuals, is often in face-to-face difficulties again. And if you live in a place where there are no Muslims, then your fear is often greater than if you live in a place where there is none, where there are many, sorry.
Well, we've got lots here in Bristol.
But there's pockets, and I know that, and there is still, there's misunderstanding. But I'm a massive advocate for multi-faith work. I was the chair of the Bristol Multi-Faith Forum for some years, helped set it up back in the mid-noughties. I've been the bishop's advisor on interfaith affairs in Bath and Wells in the past. My desire to build unity into the interfaith dialogue is foundational, but I come across an enormous amount of ignorance, and it's the ignorance about what people are wanting and what people are believing in which divides us again. I think it's the power of the division of the shadowy ones, let's put it like that.
I mean, okay, so if there is a different, okay, so maybe we can call it the forces of darkness.
Yeah, we could do powers and principalities is a nice biblical
way
of putting it.
There's certainly some dark forces around, but look, I mean, given that there is this similarity between the attack on the Jews back in the 30s and 40s and the attack on Islam since the turn of the century, what is it that the powers that be, the dark forces, if you want, are afraid of about what those people believe, what the Jews believe and what the Muslims believe?
I don't think it's about what they believe. I don't think belief comes into it, actually. I think it is very, very simple economic and financial aggression. I think it's useful to have something to label it. People like Richard Dawkins, who's disappeared from view for a fair bit now, but his hatred, it seems, of faith was that it caused wars. But, you know, we know that's a load of rubbish. Wars are caused by people not wanting other people to be where they are.
Well, they tried to say that about Northern Ireland, didn't they?
Well, indeed.
Actually, it wasn't at
all.
It
was organised crime as a feature of some of these places.
Just a bit.
You know, I mean, it isn't about whether my God is greater than your God, because as a Christian, I would say the Islamic God is the same God, actually. Pardon me for saying so. Okay, we have a different tradition, we have a different understanding of it, we have a different operating system for our faiths.
The Old Testament is this foundation for all of these.
Absolutely, it's the Abrahamic tradition. And I think that what's happened throughout, I mean, there's a, you know, a big the blood libel stuff of the Middle Ages and of how Christians turned against Jews because of the idea that they had murdered Christ and all that sort of rubbish.
Was it nothing to do with the fact that they were quite wealthy? I think in York, for example, you know.
Well, it could argue that the worst thing that ever happened to the church was that Constantine became its head back in 320. Mm. You know, it became an established faith. It was the empire's religion. That did for it in some ways. But actually the core of it, the truth of the universe, the universal Christ, if you like. It's a very good book by a guy called Richard Rohr, R-O-H-R, called The Universal Christ. And his argument is that the universal sanctification of the whole of creation is nothing to do with the formalized religions. It's about the feeling we have within us. That's the natural theology of our belief, which is
so
about,
can you go to heaven without ever going to church?
Well, put it this way. since Christ...
You do yourself out of a job here.
At the moment, I think altogether, how many hundred... I think 100 billion humans have existed. Almost all of those were before Christ. So, you know, why are we...
are they all condemned?
Well, indeed. Well, you're into Dante's first circle of hell there, aren't you? You know, and you can make up all these wonderful little sort of mythologies and you know...
So is this the sort of sermon you preach down in...
I preach a sermon of social justice, which is about recognising in other people, all other people, the value of their humanity. no matter who they are, no matter where they're from. So this lady who didn't like my attitude towards same-sex marriage, the people I meet in the food bank who are looking at me like, all right, where am I in a collar? They're looking at me like I'm something weird, and I just talk to them. And they recognise that I care. I hope they do. Most of them do. I don't think I've had anybody run away from me yet. And the people who work in, people who volunteer in the food bank are church members. And the important message that the gospel shares, which is Luke 4:18, which is Christ said, I am here to set the oppressed free, to give sight to the blind, to feed the hungry. And that is what we have to do. And it's so easy, even in churches, to say, well, I'll feed most of the hungry, but not the ones I don't like. So back to your loving your enemy. You don't have to like everybody, but you do have to recognize that God loves everybody. And then once you unlock that, you realize that's always there.
You do have to love everyone.
To try. You might not like them, but you have to love them. You have to love them. Sorry, you don't have to like them. Some people I don't get on with, and I ignore them. Sorry, whoever you are, you won't know because I've ignored you. But ultimately, the sermons I preach are about social justice and about saying the church is the heart of that. I mean, I went to church on Sunday. I'm not at a church at the moment. I'm between churches, but I went to the church I attend on a Sunday, and it was full of people looking out for each other. And just looking out for each other. I mean, I'm not making it into any more complex than that. Trouble with the social welfare system is you've got to have DBS checks, understandably. You've got to have a work plan. You've got to have a care program. You've got to have all these things in place, and you've got to pay for it. At a church, people just love each other. And I think that happens still every week in all our neighbourhoods. There's a guy who talks about church being a multinational organisation with outlets in every neighbourhood. You know, and that's what it's like. You can talk about the big stuff or the shiny. I mean, I went to Rome a few years ago and was overwhelmed at the grandeur and appalled by it in equal measure because of that vast wealth. And around the back of the Vatican are people living in destitution. But the Vatican, since Pope Francis, he now opens those doors to those homeless and lets them in. And I think that's something which I want to happen around every parish that I'm in.
So when you arrive in Bridgewater, I mean, this can be quite a rough place, actually, can't it? Were you previous people that you were with here in Bristol and Highbridge, I think you were before,
yeah.
Did they look down on you going, you're not going to Bridgewater?
Why Bridgewater, they said. And I said, look, you're in Highbridge. You know, I come from Knowle in Bristol, South Bristol. I went to Merriwood Boys in Knowle West. You know, I've lived in that world and I love it. And it's something which has a grit and a fascination. And that's not patronising. That's where life is. I've got nothing against anybody who has, you know, made it to the leafy suburbs, but actually the hard work of being alive happens in those sorts of places. And Bridgewater has its leafy suburbs, you know, and Bridgewater is a radical place as well. It's got that history of the Sedgemoor battle and the Civil War history and all that sort of radical militant background.
And the carnival.
And the carnival,
so do you take part in the carnival? It's just a pagan event, isn't it?
Well, as I say, pagan, it's a graduation from pagan to Christian, I'd say. But we all like a bit of fire, don't we? I mean, that's the carnival recognises Guy Fawkes in a big way. It's all linked with that. I'm not a carnival club member. That is an interesting tribe, if we're going to talk about tribes, actually. There are, you know, well-established, long-standing, family-linked carnival clubs that go around the southwest in the carnivals. I mean, you know, it's not just Bridgewater, it goes down to, well, there's Shepton Mallet and other places, obviously. Taunton has one, you know, but Bridgewater is the home of it. But the clubs who make the carts, not floats, get lynched if you talk about floats, they are tribes. But it's such a gathering. It's a real community identifier in Bridgewater. It's what makes Bridgewater what it is.
Well, look, you're obviously working quite closely with people having a difficult time in their lives or whatever, because that's just where the church has got to be.
Mm-hmm.
Food banks, who turns up to the food banks? What kind of people are you dealing with? Are they working, not working? Are they
both? One example, a while back, over a year ago now, for example, I obviously mentioned no names, but I was delivering, organising food in one food bank in the area. A lady came in with her partner, early 30s maybe, worked for Holiday Inn. You know, was a receptionist at Holiday Inn. And for, you know, for whatever personal reasons, and I won't go into them now, she was struggling for food. She had a full-time job. And it was a zero-hour contract, though, you know, and it was, and she'd missed a few weeks and therefore hadn't been paid. And, you know, I think people have a misunderstanding or a prejudice, let's call it that, actually, be blunt about it, a prejudice in some ways against food banks. They think they're places that feed the rather grubby underclass.
Well, they all think there's also an attitude amongst some people that there's quite a lot of scroungers in this place.
Well, frankly, if you're prepared to go to a food bank and scrounge off me, then I'll give you food, because people don't want to go to food banks. I know of plenty of people that I've seen them, have encouraged them in, wandering around outside, not wanting to come in because of the shame that goes with it. And I think, well, if somebody's going to come in to ask for food, then, hey, we got food. We do check. We do have forms and certificates that you have to hand in and get signed by people. But if somebody actually comes in, you can just tell whether they're destitute or not. We give them an emergency package. But, you know, most of the people are so grateful. In fact, no, I'd say almost all of the people are so grateful for the food we give. And so many people come back later, you know, in a year with food to donate.
So why? When we're the sixth richest country in the world.
I know.
Why have we got people queuing up outside?
Two words, universal credit. I mean, it's ever-present. Probably over half the people who come to the food bank have some form of employment, whether it's part-time or more, but mostly it's 0 hour. And it's the universal credit system, which they might come a cropper with. It works fine if you're able to work it. And if you're able to get online easily, it's no problem at all, really. But many of the people, it's only doable online. Now, most of us can get online like a piece of cake, you know, but others can't. And you can miss a meeting, you can get sanctioned, you can not realise that something's been paid twice, and so therefore the following month you get nothing and you haven't realised. And, you know, not wishing to patronise people, not everybody can work out their own finances.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
The big question is, do you think universal credit has deliberately been framed like this? Is it conspiracy or cock-up?
I think it's more cock-up. I think and in that sense, it's a cultural cock-up. I think
why would this government change something make it so that people are falling, you know, through the cracks?
Because they haven't realised that people don't budget monthly. When you're living hand to mouth, you budget at best weekly, sometimes day by day. And the rather middle class in Duncan Smith approach to a monthly or a 5 weekly in some cases cycle is actually totally countercultural to people who have very little, in which their electric meter is always on the emergency level, where their children have got to have, you know, the basics, new shoes and things like that. The washing machine goes belly up. You could argue, oh, if you're poor, you don't deserve a washing machine. I mean, this is undeserving and deserving poor rubbish again. I don't think it's conspiracy. I think it's a refusal to accept that other people live differently. And I think we can all do that. We're, you know, sort of back to the tribal stuff again. But the people who have devised universal credit, I don't think quite grasp the day-by-day worry of having no money. And they think, if I gave you 500, 600 quid at the beginning of the month, you'll work out how to spend it through the month. And that doesn't work. People don't do it. And so they get into trouble.
I think there is some criticism of the church, Simon, because looking at particularly at the leaders of the Church of England, I mean, for a start, it was created by probably the worst king Britain ever had, the guy responsible for the ruin we see at Glastonbury all over the country. And it really does seem as if it was his attempt to create his own little church that would do what he wanted. The archbishops, although there have been some famous, very brave archbishops, usually they've ended up dead, right? Have been had their heads chopped off or whatever.
Or more recent times, just sort of conveniently forgotten about.
Yeah,
like William Temple, maybe.
So, our current Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, has had a fantastic career mm-hmm. in the oil industry.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the oil industry is the industry responsible for pollution, the destruction mm-hmm. of the railways, the tyranny of the car, and yet there he is. Is this karma for him? Or
no, actually, I mean, I like many of my colleagues in the church, I subscribe to a daily news briefing from the Church of England, which is fascinating because it gives a list of the main headlines and all the main dailies, but also where the church is mentioned. And the FT often is an interesting source in regards to Justin Welby's background. And there is a lot of work being done to extricate the church's financial involvement in anti-environmental initiatives, so from oil stuff.
What about the arms industry?
Well, indeed, and it's
because the church does invest in these shares, and
indeed, when it is revealed, and unusual for me, I'm standing up for the Archbishop momentarily. He does have a desire to get away from that. Now, he's the Archbishop in that respect. We see him as the top of the tree, and he is in an episcopal sense, in a pastoral sense. He is my
line manager.
The line manager of my line manager, sort of thing. If I was
isn't Jesus supposed to be your line manager?
Well, he's the inspiration. he's the leader.
Okay.
But there is that's the issue, that the church is more and more becoming managerial, and I'm not the only one to be saying this. There's a problem with how we continue to be inspirational and lead the moral and social activities of the country, and how much we manage the church as an organisation. The church is, as many will know, the Church of England is a parochial structure, so there's a parish. Wherever you go, you are somewhere in a parish. Other churches aren't like that. There's not the parochial structure. But what's happening is that the parishes are being more and more considered as organisations themselves. So they're becoming congregational rather than parochial, so that the people who go to church on Sunday are the church. Now, my approach to this is that it's wrong, that it's the parish around, the cure of souls that a vicar has for their parish is what matters. But the organisation of the church is being led, frankly, by a lack of numbers and therefore money. I know we could argue there's lots of money in the church, but it's caught up in all kinds of things. So we're having to work in a different way. And the managerialism which is coming in is actually distracting from the moral, inspirational stuff.
I mean, you've touched on another point there, which is that you see increasingly driving around Somerset and other counties, you'll see mm-hmm. churches that have been sold off, maybe almost mothballed. Parish churches.
I'm pretty ambivalent about that. I mean, if a church is not working, then, if there's only five people going every two Sundays, then let's close that. Let's find another way of doing it. But doesn't change the truth of God. I think again, that is a sort of a managerial response.
Are we just rejecting God, or is it the Church of England that's doing things wrong? Surely what this tells us is that people generally, youngsters as they're growing up mm-hmm. over the last 40, 50, 60, 70 years, are slowly thinking, well, actually, there's nothing here for me. Why should I go to church on Sunday?
I think there is that. I think because we've not revealed sufficiently, we've not helped God to reveal the reality of what Christianity is all about, which is when you go back to people like St. Francis in the 13th century, who was preaching a very stripped-down version of Christianity, which was about being poor and about identifying with the people on the margins. That's Luke 4:18 again. He was up against a church which was extremely wealthy, extremely powerful, and caught up in all this argy-bargy about with the Holy Roman Empire. And that overtook, the political, the earthly overtook. And people are like that now, I feel, in that we are not sure where we stand. Personally, my ministry is always out in the community. And if you look at the Gospels, Jesus is in church, synagogue, for four times, pretty much. And each time he's in there, he's in trouble. At one point, they want to throw him off a cliff. Another point, they want to drown him, I think. Another point, they'd just argue with him, you're not welcome here. He's hounded out.
They plot to kill him as well.
Well, in the end, of course, with the authorities arguably do that. But yes, it's the powers that be, and the Pharisees are part of that. But where Jesus does his ministry is out in the street. He deals with people where they are. He draws in the sand. He touches people. He walks through crowds, and people want to see him, and he ministers in the world. The church needs to do that. But what's happening is we are protecting miracles, our buildings.
Things like these miracles, aren't they just fairy stories?
I think they are... for me, they are signs and wonders. They are sacraments. They are mysteries. Now, I don't understand how they might have happened. And as a scientist, I certainly have questions about how you can transform water into wine. But it's the nature of the books that are written about them, around them. So the Gospels of Matthew, Mark, Luke and John, which tell the stories of Jesus, and the Acts of the Apostles, which comes after, is all about showing how Jesus was actually reforming the history of the world so far. And this is not particularly mainstream at all, but I'm saying that Jesus is seen as a transformer, and I'm saying as a reformer. If you look at the Old Testament, which is full of all kinds of wonderful stories about transformation and revelation, Jesus was saying, hold on, guys, we've got to do it, continue to do it. Which is going back to my point about process theology. Jesus was saying, we're in a process. This isn't something we can fix and then sit down and have a cup of tea and turn the TV on and everything's sorted. It's always going on.
A slow education over thousands of years.
Absolutely.
Going on here.
Yeah.
From, I suppose, people just kind of... I mean, some of the stuff in the Old Testament is amazing, isn't it?
Wonderful stuff.
Killing.
Yeah.
Absolutely brutal and ruthless.
It's horrible.
You know, it's really... And that is supposed to be the thing to do for the Jews in Jerusalem, etc. But
that's a literal interpretation.
A growing understanding of what life is really all about and what the difference between right and wrong is. But look, Church of England, what about Brexit? It's not Britain, but I mean, surely this issue does come up from time to time. It's a big issue for the whole country. It's dividing people.
It's revealing division, I think. I mean, it's, you know, the old saw of we're not allowed to talk about religion or politics. Well, actually, that's no problem now. We just didn't talk about Brexit. You know, you're allowed to talk about the other two. But I think what the whole thing of Brexit, and I use quotes, air quotes, is that it's revealed the division that was already there. I don't think necessarily that was that 2016 suddenly broke Britain apart. It just revealed the break that we were not acknowledging.
It's always been. I mean, since I can remember I wasn't old enough to vote, but I can remember the referendum back in the 1970s.
Me too, yeah.
And it was very divisive at the time. It's always been. And I think probably fair to say in both the main parties, there's been tribes on both sides.
Well, absolutely.
Seething at each other's throats.
You can throw all kinds of things at David Cameron, and I think he didn't do any good favours to us all. And certainly the fixed term parliamentary bill and that sort of thing act, that made things difficult. His desire was to unify his party, and it's all gone pretty badly wrong. I think everybody would agree. But we don't just blame David Cameron for this. I think there is something about Britain which has to deal with itself in a way which Brexit is just revealing. And there's, at the same time, we have Scotland, we have Northern Ireland, we have all kinds of divisions, and I'm not a big fan of devolution in general. I'm not a big fan of anything which breaks anything up, which is why I'm not a big fan of having metropolitan mayors, because it sets one city up against another, and we're back to ancient Greece almost. You know, the Spartans having a go at the Athenians. Well, no, we are a nation of confused migrants, and we need to live that world rather than give ourselves reasons to divide, which is, I think, what Brexit has done. It's given us a reason to be divided. And although I am different to you, I voted Remain, I'm thinking, well, you know, it's not going well, to be polite. It wouldn't go any better if suddenly we revoked Article 50, because the division has been released. The genie is out of the tin, the toothpaste is out of the tube. What do? We can't go back, so we have to work on reconciliation.
Now, there's lots of other things going on in other parts of Europe, not to try and labour a point too much, but in Italy, for example, the rulers of the country are being imposed on the people. So they want to have, say, for example, a prime minister or a finance minister or whatever, and they're told, no, you can't have that person because they're not, you know, this is a technocrat people. Goldman Sachs, people like that being imposed on countries. In Greece, they had a vote. They said, we have decided we want out of the euro. We've had enough of it. We want to go back to the drachma. Nothing happened. You've got Catalonia trying to secede from Madrid, and they're put in jail. The politicians successfully won a vote.
Response.
I mean, it's this does seem.
And
like
I
it's
think this is being
heading
again,
in a chaotic direction here.
Absolutely, and I think I don't know who's responsible. I'm sure, obviously, something is responsible. Whether it's a body or a person, I'm not sure. But there is something at the heart of all this, which is revealing an ignorance about people's responsibilities and roles in our democracies. And I'm talking about all across Europe, and bigger than that, there's been a huge outcry about, you know, rather militant and extreme leavers saying, you know, we want our democracy back. Almost, you know, we've broke it. You know, how dare you not?
Well, I put it as simply as this:
but actually, people need to see that we need to work together to bring it about.
We've got people in charge who see themselves as masters, not servants. And that's, I suppose, key to understanding why what's happening is happening.
Well, that's why I don't think you can put the toothpaste back in the tube, because it just isn't possible. But people aren't, at the moment, the debacle of deceit, I suppose, to be alliterative, like Boris Johnson loves. The debacle of deceit is what's actually not allowing reconciliation to happen. And I think that the debacle recently of Rabbi Mervis and then Justin Welby talking about anti-Semitism in a way which is divisive, whether it's true or not, is actually divisive. And I think they, as faith leaders, need to find ways of not doing that. But at the same time, the deceit, which is being encouraged, sadly, by mainstream media, it seems, to the outsider like myself. You may have a different view on it, Tony, because you're much more involved in that world than I am. But it seems like the only stories are the ones which reveal a bit of a dirty underbelly, but nobody is held to account for that. I have a personal thing, a mission against deceit. If you're shown to be having done something wrong, then accept it and then move on. Don't try and say, no, it didn't happen, and then move on, because everybody knows it did. And I think that the world of politics nowadays, you say the masters are shaping the stories because they don't want to admit to having been fallible.
I mean, the big thing with anti-Semitism, surely, is the difference between hatred of Jewish people for being Jews and criticism, or maybe even hatred, of the Israeli state, which is, it's now officially a racist state. They have laws now which are racist laws, every bit as bad as what was in South Africa in the 1980s. So it's very strange to see somebody saying, well, you know, the Labour Party has got this problem with anti-Semitism. Really, surely, the Labour Party's problem... The Labour Party has a problem with Israel.
Absolutely.
And the racism of Israel.
I struggle, I really, really struggle to understand why this is not being put to bed more easily. And it feels like the only recourse I can have is to say that somebody's fanning the flame. But the Zionism versus anti-Semitism problem seems to me so blooming obvious.
Yeah, we don't often hear Zionism mentioned on Channel 4 News or whatever.
No.
Occasionally it does come up, but usually raised by Jews, actually.
Well, indeed. Am I right in saying that actually the notion of Zionism comes into the definition of anti-Semitism as well, that was not adopted?
To.
Well, I think that is a weird thing in itself.
It shouldn't be. No, of course it shouldn't be.
And I've been surprised by people who were, my friends who are progressive Jews, who are rather more Zionist than I would have thought.
Well, apparently, if you say the state of Israel shouldn't exist, and that is what Zionism is, it's all about the forwarding of the rights of the state of Israel. If you say that the state of Israel shouldn't exist, then you're anti-Semitic, according to some of these definitions, which I just think is a complete misnomer.
I mean, Israel is a state, it is there, so let's do something with it. But it does strike me that Mervis saying that, having been quoted as saying that violent or force is needed to deal with Gaza, doesn't seem to me to be helping. However, it is a very literal approach to Old Testament scripture.
What do you make of this conflict between Iran and Israel? Because this seems to be brewing all the time. You know, you've got a nuclear-armed Israel, actually, and there seems to be a lot of support in the West generally for Israel's belligerent talk towards Iran. Now, Iran has got its own problems. It's you know, it's had its revolution.
Iran, I must admit. I'm confused because it seems to be, it doesn't need to be that sort of problem, I suppose. And I can see sort of why Israel is a conflict area because of the historical sort of intensity of it. But Iran seems to me to have been, let Iran be. Why does it have to be so aggressive towards others? And I think it's only in response to something, but then maybe I'm just taking the underdog.
Well, what are we doing in the Middle East, by the way? Do you know? The British, the Americans, we always seem to be sort of sending soldiers over, doing this.
I don't know. Tony Blair tried a bit, didn't he? That worked well.
Because this is the Holy Land, but it's not looking too good, is it? It seems like that...
Well, it's an interface. I mean, my background in biology is I used to work with... doing research on the way bacteria foul ship bottoms. You know, that's an esoteric place to go, isn't it? But actually, it had a very economic issue about slowing ships down, so their fuel consumption was bigger. Bacteria grow best when there's an interface between something, where energy moves across interfaces and it concentrates interfaces. So on a ship's hull, there's more energy to be gained so a bacterium can get a foothold. And to scale that up massively to places of conflict are often interfaces between cultures because that's where the energy is. And the way, whereas bacteria grow, what happens in geopolitical situations is there is often more heat than light. And I think, and the Balkans is a similar thing. You look at most conflict zones and it's because there's a major cultural difference. And I think, the Iron Curtain was another of those. There was the Slavic, European conflicts. They are conflicts generated by cultural interfaces. And I think that's why the Middle East has been like it for so long, because there was a cultural interface. A ship's bottom, which is a piece of steel, you can change the nature of cultural interfaces a bit, and which is Northern Ireland is another one. Mm. You can reconcile, you can seek to reconcile, and you can dissolve away the interface. Reconciliation is totally ignored at the moment. If it's used, it's used in a way which nobody really works out. I did some, being a nerd, I did some etymological research on the word reconciliation, and it comes down to a very ancient notion of combing your hair. Cilia is the Latin for hair, to concilia, to make your hair nicely combed. And actually, that's what reconciliation is to get the tangles out. And that's what needs to happen. You don't do that by throwing bombs at people.
No, or just giving people large, vast amounts of money.
It tangles things up.
Yeah, to sort of dish out. There's almost like bribes of various sorts. But anyway, look, the other thing I know you're quite passionate about is the environment. And you've been involved a bit with this Extinction Rebellion movement down...
In Bridgewater?
Yeah.
Yeah. One day a guy I bumped into on Facebook said to me, or said to anybody out there interested in doing something about XR, it was just after the Bristol event... And I put my head above the parapet and said, "Yeah, I'm interested. How do we go?" And we've got about, 20 people together. We're still champing at the bit to do stuff. The guy who organised it, he went to the London thing recently, and there's a Taunton group and there are affinity groups all around.
Yeah,
and we're just working out how to do something, which I'm not a big fan of blocking streets, I must admit. I'm a rather fearful Extinction Rebel, I think. I don't want to upset people too much, but I do want them to see the problem.
Okay, so China is the biggest problem on the planet.
Yeah.
Why are we protesting here and saying, oh, we've got to stop things?
It's a long way to China.
But the air comes around
the world,
doesn't
it? I agree. And the basis of the XR movement is to upscale stuff so that the people who have the power to make a difference realise that they have got to do it. If I'm honest, we're back to the carrier bag with the apples in. It's pulling through my hand and I'm worried the bag's going to break. I've still got hope. Still got hope that something will happen. But it damn well won't happen if we don't mention it to people who can make it happen. I think all of social change in the past how many hundreds, thousands of years has been about idiots carrying on banging out against a brick wall.
Eventually.
Slavery was a good example.
Burst. Hopefully. Mm. Anyway, look, you're someone who's had this journey from militant atheism to...
militant Christian.
To putting the...
I'm happy with that.
So fair play to you. But what would you say to anyone that's sort of thinking, well, actually, there's really nothing to this God thing. It's just a silly fairy tale.
I can't make them believe. Only God can do that, is what I say. I didn't wake up one morning thinking, oh, I wish I believed. Oh, good, I do. It wasn't like that. I'd say, yeah, you carry on. As long as you are kind, and polite. I sound like my mum here. Good to people, and look at everybody and see in them goodness. Even the people you think are the worst on the planet. You've got to find the good in people. Otherwise, you can't comb your hair.
Simon Bale, thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
By the way, finally, sorry. So whereabouts, if people want to locate you, whereabouts are you these days?
I'm in Bridgewater. By locate, do you mean physically?
Well, I mean sort of online or whatever.
Online, I'm on Facebook, Simon Bale. Twitter is Simon J. Bale. Look me up. I'm public. Too public, probably. But it's good to talk to you again, Tony.
Nice to see you, Simon. Well, that's all for this week. Dialects Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. You can download it to listen on your phone or in the car. Suggest interviewees, subscribe to our email list, and listen the week before broadcast if you like at our website, dialectsradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guest, Simon Bale, Church of England vicar, now working down in Bridgewater. Also to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. Contact us through the People's Republic of Stokescroft, just off Jamaica Street. They're online at prsc.org.uk, or you can even just call round. If you have some of your precious time to spare, you can volunteer with us or for hundreds of opportunities elsewhere in Britain via the National Volunteering website, do-it.org. Thanks for listening to Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. I'll be back on Friday with my two-hour BCFM politics show, live from 6 till 8 p.m. Meanwhile, till next Tuesday midday, from the Dialect crew, goodbye for now. Thank you.